You and I know we live in a violent world. We know that we live in a world of nuclear proliferation, of gigantic air, water, and solid pollution, of a population explosion, of poverty, squalor, and disease in third world have-not, so-called developing countries. The pictures we see coming out of Haiti are only indicative of hundreds of nations like that, all around the periphery of Southeast Asia, throughout all of the former Soviet Union, in Central and South America, in the islands of the sea, in third world countries like Bangladesh and India, and all over Africa for that matter, where the state of the human family is one usually of poverty, squalor, endemic disease, sickness, of would-be despots, warlords, and dictators controlling the lives of millions of suffering human beings who are, like as not, dying of starvation. And even when best-intentioned weak leaders like that of the United States of America attempt to try to democratize certain nations, like insisting that Aristide be reinstated after the elections that allegedly put him in power in Haiti, we try to do so by embargoes of sorts or by sanctions, which lead to some of the incredible pictures we have seen now coming from Haiti from doctors in children's hospitals who say that the oil has now run out, so they cannot any longer run their generators, so there is no electrical power, that people are pushing their automobiles, that the people that we are seeking to save are the people who are being hurt, and that allegedly 1,000 children every few days are dying of starvation because there is no food. You and I, like spectators on the world scene, if we sit and watch our morning television, our weekly television, and our weekly news magazines, daily newspapers, we are bombarded in a matter of a few hours with so many incredible problems, with a host of murders, of drug busts, of neighborhood upsets, of wife beatings, of child molestations, of kidnappings, of cop shootings, that we are overstressed to the tune of 10 or 20 years in the life of a pioneer in only about 24 hours. Have you ever thought of it from the standpoint of your stress level? Of just how much your mind and your emotions can take as you watch what is happening all around you. Isaiah, the prophet of God, sent to actually convey a message from God, not just to one specific nation, but to all the nations, was told to cry aloud, "Spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins." That's in Isaiah 58 and verse 1. In this message, I intend to do exactly that. All of us remember, if we've been around long enough, the nihilism, the anti-establishment attitudes of the hippies and the drug scenes of the 1960s, of the Vietnam anti-war demonstrations, of the kids with their peace symbols who were living in places like the notorious pig farm north of Albuquerque, New Mexico, who, when health and social workers went in there among them and found virulent new strains of venereal disease because they were living just like pigs and they were cohabiting like so many lice and vermin, and found that they were coming up with new strains of different types of things like syphilis, gonorrhea, chancroid, herpes, genital warts, and so on. And they asked those young hippies with their raggedy clothes and long hair and weird-looking little Volkswagen vans to just lay off for a while, just quit the sex for a while and give these medical people time to get in there, identify some of these new strains of venereal disease and do something about it. No, they said, they wouldn't do that at all. And so open and free sex was the way of that era. How many of us have not heard of situation ethics? And today, the liberals who are in command in the White House and throughout the various ministries of government, the various secretaries of this and that and the other, our attorney generalists, or whoever else she might be, the one of the famous defective condoms in Arkansas, who says that one of the problems of health is violent crime because there are victims who are sometimes injured or killed. So everything suddenly is becoming a health problem, which of course I knew it would when she was appointed many months ago, simply because I had heard what the First Lady had been saying even before that time, trying to make mental health move on over into practically everything we say, think, and do, including our political choices, including our religious choices, And believe me, the time is going to come when the government is going to decide that if you believe in God, believe in the Bible, believe in the Ten Commandments and obedience to God, believe in teaching your children to pray to God, that you are actually contravening some kind of a law. Of course, we've already got that in the United States, haven't we? It's perfectly all right for you to tune in to evening television and listen to every kind of scatological reference, to see people mouthing each other with their tongues in each other's mouths like they were eating an apple, to see absolute blatant raw sex scenes. That's perfectly all right, isn't it? It's all right for famous movie actresses and actors to take God's name in vain, to use every kind of filthy four-letter word, the F word, their chosen one, and especially among blacks, that other word they put with it that is so utterly despicable that it isn't even worth pronouncing or reminding you of. That's perfectly all right, isn't it? There is no Supreme Court law against that, is there? You and your children can be treated to a never-ending stream of the most incredible bloodlust, blood-crazed violence of mayhem, murder, muggings, rape, arson, robbery, strangulation, stabbings, bludgeonings, and gunshots and gasoline explosions almost nonstop in some of these Schwarzenegger type of movies that are being shown in the movie theaters and on television. And that's not against the law, is it? But you know what is against the law? It is against the law for your six-year-old to stand up in the first grade and to say publicly in front of those other children, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." That is against the law in the United States of America. It is not against the law to show sodomy, to show homosexuality, to show transvestism, to have every kind of a scatological reference in your language on public television. But it is against the law, according to the judges, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, for you, for me, for our children to pray in public schools. They stand in absolute, flagrant, abominable defiance to Almighty God, who is going to actually break their bones and break their backs and is going to bend their knees and force them eventually to bow down and to worship Him. It is no wonder that much of our mail we can characterize as another one of those letters that is really saying, with a kind of a whimper, written probably from those the Bible describes as, quote, those who sigh and cry for all the abominations that they see around them all the time, as another one of those letters which is essentially a letter that is saying, without saying it, "Thy kingdom come." We get letters that we go over in our Thursday morning prayer breakfasts that detail such horrifying things as a letter here some months ago from a black family in the south side of Chicago, where there was a party that involved drugs and alcohol, and where a little five-year-old baby girl had been left asleep on a bed in a bedroom, and they came back in, some adult came in later on and found that child dead. That child had been raped and murdered while a neighborhood kind of an alcohol drug party was going on, a little baby girl. Now, I could, you know, sit here before the microphone and tell you about thousands of all kinds of crimes and sins and tell you what is happening around you. I don't need to do that. You're fully aware of it. You're aware of child kidnappings, of pedophilia and child molestation. You're aware of the murders that we see, and we just saw one, two actually, this morning. A police officer was gunned down by two young blacks in a parking lot of a neighborhood here just yesterday in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. One of them only 17 years of age. So it's no wonder that God's prophets are told to cry aloud, "Spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sin." What is sin? Do you know that most people would actually hoot and snort and derisively cry, maybe even give you some obscene gestures and some raspberries if you dare to talk about sin? Because in today's climate, there is no such thing as right or wrong. From the situation ethics of the 60s, and before that, German rationalism of the 30s, to that gray area of no absolutes that led to the anti-establishment nihilism and the hedonism of if it feels good, do it, of the hippie and the drug era of the 1960s, the United States has been on a toboggan slide into an absolute slop chute of vomit. And Great Britain has, if anything, preceded us down that slop chute They were showing full frontal nudity on television in the 1960s over in Great Britain. And if you want to find out someone who looks like a whole bunch of Yorkshire hogs, at the slop chute or the slop trough, just greedily gobbling up absolutely inedible, undigestible trash and garbage, you ought to look at the insatiable appetite of the British public in the light of their tabloids and their royalty watch and their picture of Princess Di in a very, what I would say would be unladylike position, when the poor thing was merely in her private club exercising with some dumbbells and some weights to keep in shape, but they've got a peephole in the ceiling taking pictures of her in that little brief, and millions of British vicariously get all kinds of a kick out of that. And if you've ever seen some of those British tabloids take on anybody who believes in God or the Bible, it is something to behold. And I have had personal acquaintance with that because I've run into a number of them. I've been interviewed by them. And one of them, from a publication called The Sun, actually brought about the death of our deputy chancellor of Ambassador College, the dean, rather, of the college, back in the middle 1960s, Dr. Benjamin Ray. Came in there and was actually harassing him and talking to him in such a terrible way, saying, "I understand that you're teaching classes on sex over here." And they had a headline that talked about Bible and sex taught at Ambassador College in Brickett Wood. This was back in the 1960s. And this reporter, so frustrated and so emotionally upset, Dr. Benjamin Ray, who was a Korean War veteran who had had a mortar go off near him and consequently had a big metal plate in his skull and was very hypertensive. He was overweight. He had a little bit of a heart problem. And lo and behold, he became so excited and energized and just frustrated by this reporter's evil, rotten, piercing questions that Dr. Ray's blood vessels burst in his brain. He went into a coma, and before 1 or 2 a.m. that very same next morning, he was dead as a result of a confrontation with one of these rotten British tabloid writers. My contempt for the liberal press and the liberal media is absolutely complete, I will tell you that. Now, God's Word says in 1 John 3:4, sin is the transgression of the law. Sin is the violation of God's law. No one seems to understand that the Ten Commandments of God cover, in broad parameters, every nuance and every conceivable activity of the human being. That they regulate business, industry, art, literature, music, science, government, politics, education. They regulate the family. They regulate cultural associations and relationships. They regulate interpersonal relationships. They regulate relationships between parent and child, husband and wife. They have to do with the way society ought to function. Now, if you've never read my booklet called The Ten Commandments, let me tell you a little bit about it right quickly. And if you're listening to this, as you probably are, on a tape recorder in your automobile or your home, you can stop it wherever you want to. You can do it right now and write for that booklet, if you don't possess it, called The Ten Commandments, that goes through everything about the laws of God and in a way you have never seen it done before. It's a thick, substantial booklet of 85 pages. And it goes through every one of God's laws. And in one way, it goes through each one of the commandments one by one, showing what our society would be like if even one of God's laws, for example, the law against thou shalt not steal, if even one of those laws were applied to our nation today, if there were no such thing as a thief, that would mean no robbers, no muggers, no burglars, no bank robbers, no SNL scam artists, no inside traders. It would mean that nobody like the Beskies and the other people who have actually cost multiple billions of dollars to the American taxpayer have actually dealt gigantic blows to the whole national economy because of the incredible greed of one man, like the man that was thrown in prison as a result of a Lincoln savings scandal. If you had none of that, do you realize there would be no prisons, no jails, there would be no labor camps? There would be no camps for youths. There would be no police force. There would be no criminal justice system. There would not be anywhere near the size of the police forces we have today. And this nation would literally save probably far more money in a few years than the total national debt if we just had no thievery, no stealing, no crime. And if you get this booklet entitled The Ten Commandments and read it slowly and thoroughly, you will come to understand far more than you ever had before about God's law. And while I'm at it, I want to mention this brochure, Are Christians, quote, under the law, end quote. You know, Dr. Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, who shall I mention, Dr. Shuler, it wouldn't matter. None of those people would tell you that it is perfectly all right for you to commit murder. It's perfectly all right to commit adultery. It's perfectly all right to murder, to rape, to rob, to set fire to half of Southern California, or to steal the point of a knife or something else. None of them would say that. So by and large, all of these ministers believe that the Ten Commandments should be obeyed except one. They all believe we should have no other gods before us. They all believe that we should not worship idols if they are Protestants as opposed to Catholics. They all believe that we should obey all of those wonderful commandments that regulate human life and life together with a husband and a wife or children or a family or a neighborhood or a community or a society or a nation. They all believe in that. But not a one of the ones that I have mentioned believe in obeying the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment was a test commandment. And you see that in the 16th and 18th chapters of the book of Exodus, even before Mount Sinai, and you see it throughout the Bible, and you see it all the way to the fourth chapter of Hebrews and the 22nd chapter of the book of Revelation. That is the Sabbath day. That the Sabbath day is to be kept. And there are millions of people who will argue with you until you're blue in the face that, well, all that's been changed. Well, by whom? Not by God, not by Jesus Christ of Nazareth, not by the early New Testament apostles. It was not changed. But it was changed about 300 years later by the prelates who were seizing the power of the then emerging Roman Catholic Church. And you can demonstrate that historically. You see, that's the only command of all of God's Ten Commandments that people absolutely will not obey. Of course, broad segments of society pay no attention to any of the Ten Commandments, as we know. But even when it gets down to fundamentalists who are supposed to be on the right wing politically, who are labeled conservative, even they will not obey the Fourth Commandment. Now, back to what is sin. Sin is the breaking of any one of God's laws as they are broadly pointed out and explained under the terms of the Ten Commandments. But it reaches into every possible nuance of human behavior. And just because you don't know that doesn't mean you're exempt from it. You're not exempt from the hidden unseen laws of physics and chemistry. If you drink a poison, it's going to kill you. If you jump off a building, even if you're unaware of gravity and inertia, as little babies are, it's going to kill you. Gravity is going to pull you down, and inertia is going to splatter you and kill you when you land at the bottom. You don't have to be aware of gravity and inertia for a fall off of a tall building if you're only 6 months old to kill you. It is exactly the same with regard to the laws of God that regulate all of human life. Now, let's just talk for a moment about what's happening in our society in terms of the criminal justice system. Every one of us know that the criminal justice system is terribly overburdened, that the cases that are brought to court are backlogged so badly. But if I were to be on television now instead of talking on the radio studio here and talking to you via a tape recording, I could take an 8.5 by 11 white piece of paper, and down in the lower right-hand corner, I would draw a little square. And that little square would represent, it would be a 1-inch square in an 8.5, a regular piece of typing paper about the size of your, you know, Time Newsweek magazine. And down in the right-hand corner, that white piece of paper would be a little box. The white piece of paper represents all crime in your community. The little box represents criminals apprehended. Now, take the little box, and the next page you've got, the little box becomes a great big box. And that great big box has a little 1-inch square down in the corner, and that represents, out of those apprehended, the number who are actually tried for the crime they committed, who didn't plea bargain, weren't immediately let go, didn't talk their way out of it, or didn't simply get placed on probation by a judge who didn't even want to bring them to trial. Now you take another one of those little boxes in the third page, and you expand it to a full page, and that represents the number who were convicted of the crime that they committed. And then you take another little box, a little portion of those who go to jail. And then you take another little box, and that little box is the portion who serve the sentence, the full sentence, for the crime for which they were convicted. And by the time you're through with all of this, you know what you've got in the total picture of crime? Way back there on page number one, with the box that represented the number of criminals apprehended, you've got a little tiny speck, so small you can't even see it. And that represents the number of crooks, druggists, drug addicts and drug pushers, rapists, arsonists, murderers, muggers, people of every type of, you know, burglars, etc., who are actually paying for the crime they committed. We can't build jails and prisons fast enough. Do you know one of the newest industries that is making an awful lot of people a lot of money, especially here in the state of Texas? Private people who get together and find some land and find them some money somewhere, banks and insurance companies, go out and put together a package and build a huge prison. And then they are running it privately. They hire their own private security people. They're in the private business today, entrepreneurship, of building prisons and then letting the judges and so on know that they got a jail available to put these people in. Now, the reason that an awful lot of murderers and violent criminals are put out on the streets very quickly is because of the so-called overcrowded conditions in our jails and prisons. And because they don't have, quote, enough beds, end quote, for them. You know my reaction to that? They say it's inhuman to overcrowd them. Why, those poor drug heads, those burglars, those arsonists, those rapists, those muggers and beaters of little old ladies, those criminals who have viciously stabbed and slashed and beaten and cudgeled and bludgeoned and strangled and shot other human beings, why, those poor little dears wouldn't have a bed to sleep in. And you must not overcrowd them, because we've proved that if you overcrowd rats, that makes them nervous. And you wouldn't want a criminal to be nervous. That would be inhumane. They would be subject to undue stress. You ever hear of Andersonville in the Civil War? That terrible prison somewhere, I believe, in North Carolina, wasn't it, where it was merely a great big open area that they strung barbed wire around and they put all of these Union prisoners in, and so many of them died of starvation. Ever heard of Baden-Belsen? Ever heard of Majdanek, of Auschwitz and Dachau? Now, those were inhuman death camps. But they started out before the so-called Final Solution by Eichmann and Adolf Hitler, of being concentration camps. Concentration means what it says. It means concentrating a lot of people in one area. And originally, in the heyday when the Nazis came to power, the people who went to concentration camps were communist thugs, people convicted of all kinds of crimes, sometimes political crimes, homosexuals. Believe it or not, in the early days of Hitler's Third Reich, homosexuality was a crime for which you were jailed. You were sent off to a concentration camp. And later on, little by little, they began putting Jews in there, and eventually it became an inhuman torture chamber. I would never advocate that, but I would advocate the most rudimentary types of camps. I would advocate camps like those in which we placed Japanese who were loyal Americans and whose sons went off to fight in a division in Italy and in Europe, who got one of the highest percentages of presidential unit citations and medals of any other organization during World War II. And it has been something of which the United States has had to be ashamed and to pay a certain number of reparations and try to make it up to those Japanese families in that hysteria in the early part of World War II, who were put in effect, concentration camps. There was one up by Tule Lake, for example, in Northern California, and were moved away into areas where it was just a vast, big desert area with a lot of barracks and practically nothing to do. There wasn't any idea there about being humane. Each one of them had to have a bed. They've got to have a machine shop or a tool shop. They've got to have access to law books. They've got to have access to a library. Each one of them has got to have access to a television set. They've got to have lounges. They've got to have 3 square meals a day. Well, it's no wonder that we can't build jails and prisons fast enough. A lot of jails and prisons look like a palatial estate in comparison with the way millions of people live in shantytown around Rio de Janeiro, or around Port-au-Prince in Haiti, or around Bangladesh, or around Bombay, India. And you can go there and look at what I'm talking about. And those people don't have beds and clean sheets and television and libraries and machine shops. Those people live in squalor and poverty and disease and sickness, and you cannot believe some of the pictures you see. I could take you into neighborhoods in Manila, the Philippines, that would make you want to vomit. And that's not a jail. Now, we have this lady with a rank of general. You know, there are people in churches like to call themselves general. I don't know if they got any pastor's corporal or pastor's sergeant major or pastor's lieutenant colonel or anything, but they got a pastor general. And we have an attorney general, you know. I guess a generalist. And you know what she said recently? I saw her being interviewed. She was before a Senate subcommittee, and she was testifying. And she said, we all know that one of the major causes of, how was it she put it, one of the major causes of crime and violence is poverty. Oh, do we all know that? That is one of the dumbest statements I have ever heard any human being make, especially at a cabinet-level government position. That is one of the dumbest statements that you've ever heard anybody make. I can take you to surgeon. Did I say attorney general? I meant surgeon general, not attorney general. I can take you to country after country after country, countries in which I have been, like Bangladesh, like India. Take you to Egypt, for example, one of the most impoverished nations on the face of the earth. Here is a city, Cairo, that probably should only have somewhere around a 500,000 or 1 million people in its environs, and instead there are 7 to 10 million people. I could take you to Mexico City and show you the same thing. In some of the shanty towns around some of these squalid, overcrowded, huge megalopolises that are just festering areas of disease and so on. Now, in these Arab countries, because they have the notion that they should still have laws that say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, smiting for smiting and burning for burning, and because their laws in fundamental Islam are very, very closely parallel with some of the laws of the Old Testament of your Bible, they are all but crime-free. Here they are in massive, mind-boggling poverty. They're in this poverty. All of them are impoverished. Our poor look like rich people compared to some of them, and yet they've got a very low crime rate. Why is that? That's because of law. That's because of law and order. It's because their criminal justice system is very different from ours. It's because if somebody steals in one of those nations, he is likely to lose his hand from the wrist down. If someone commits adultery, they're likely to be put in a big vacant lot, buried in a pit up to their shoulders with their arms pinioned to their sides, or they tamp down the dirt, and then a crowd picks up a bunch of rocks and stands around and throws it at them until they're dead, and a pile of stones marked their graves, and they walk off and leave them there. So they have almost no crime. No matter what our surgeon generalist says, I can walk down the streets in some of these slum areas in Cairo, Egypt, and other Arab countries where the rule of Islam and the laws of Islam are in place, and I can have an expensive watch, an expensive ring, expensive cufflinks, expensive clothing on my body and back, and I am unmolested, and I can walk around at night in those big cities without any fear. I could not do that in Tyler, Texas, where I live. I could not do that. If you look at our newspaper in Tyler, Texas, there are drive-by shootings all the time now. There have been something like 65 of them in 1 year. And it is true in all the big cities. So to have someone at the cabinet level of government trying to espouse this old, tattered, shop-worn theory that the reason all these young blacks are out here killing people and robbing and setting fire to their neighborhood and strangling and raping and so on is because of poverty is just absolutely not true. Poor doesn't mean criminal automatically at all. Christ said, God says, the poor you shall always have with you. There were always poor. But being poor is no excuse to be evil. Being poor is no excuse to be a criminal. I'm going to show you how it all got started. Do you know that the black community in the United States of America is suffering up to a 66% illegitimacy rate. It's about 40% for whites, which means that the raw number of white illegitimate children every single year is a larger number than the blacks, because the blacks only represent about 14% of society. Now, you wouldn't know that just looking at television. You wouldn't know that looking at your media. You would assume it's 50, 60, 70%. But it is only 14%. Now, let me explain how and why that got started. Way back during the days of slavery, the black male was suspect. Way back during the days of Reconstruction, the black male was suspect. All during the pre-civil rights era, the black male was suspect. And he was suspect because of the infamy of a few cases here and there where a rape would take place, and to a lot of whites, especially in the South, the absolute worst case scenario that could ever occur would be a black male raping a white woman. There were cases where blacks had been lynched in the South in the pre-civil rights era, where they even looked at a white woman walking along. A lot of rednecks would become inflamed and impassioned and angry, and they would grab the poor unfortunate guy and string him up to the nearest tree. That can be documented, by the way. Now, because of that, until the beginning of the civil rights movement, and at least its partial success, there had been, in the United States of America, no emerging black middle class. Now there is, at long last and belatedly. And here or there are places where what I'm about to tell you is really not applicable and is not quite true. But by and large, because there has not been allowed by a combination of all types of repressive acts, and I'm not going to get into racism here and talk about some kind of a white conspiracy that is a part of all of the white community of middle America and everybody lives in Nebraska, because it's just simply not true. It's not the way most people feel toward the blacks. They want them to succeed. They feel that character is a matter of merit, a matter of quality of character, and of your consciousness, of your emotion, shall I say, and your innermost psyche, and it has nothing to do with the color of a man's skin. You can be a very evil, perverted, twisted, bestial, rotten, filthy serial killer like a Ted Bundy who was white, or you can be the same thing if you do the same things if you're black. And one doesn't matter one way or the other whether or not a person is of this or that color. But because there has been no emerging father figure in the United States until very recently, and because only in certain areas in the United States is there a growing and more affluent, by the way, black middle class, now just beginning to really become a black middle class and even a black upper class, there are still so many millions who are down there below the poverty level. And there are so many of these youngsters who are growing up who had no stable home environment, who had none of the training they should have had from the Word of God, from a father and mother in their respective places, and consequently do not know the difference between right and wrong. And they have seen all of this around them in entertainment. They've seen the movies and the television. The average youngster, black or white, growing up in the United States has witnessed tens of thousands of murders, of cases of arson, of automobiles exploding and blowing up, of war, of machine gun fights, of chainsaw murders and stabbings and rape and you name it. He has sat there from a little child, a little impressionable baby, a little child, and seen tens of thousands of those murders and so on by the time he ever toddles off to the first grade. Most parents don't know. I mean, you can hear these people, some of them conservatives, saying, well, if you don't like Beavis and Butthead, turn it off. Well, sure, that simplistic answer seems to appeal to someone if he is thinking of the traditional family. There's dad, there's mom, and there are two kids, a boy and a girl, and they're about, 14 and 16. That's all fine. That's well and good. But it doesn't apply to the millions of single parents who are cocktail waitresses, truck drivers, and maybe standing out alongside the road with a stop sign working with a road gang somewhere, whose kids are in a daycare center or, like as not, with grandma. And maybe there are several of them. And because the government has made it in the welfare programs lucrative for young single women in the big urban areas to have 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 children, and their welfare check goes up every time they have another one, and they don't have to be responsible for them, they turn them out onto the street. and they become a member of a street gang while the woman is raking in this money from social programs and welfare and so-called entitlements. She doesn't have any sense of values, or she wouldn't have five or six children by five or six different men whose names she probably doesn't even know. And so here you are with an entire generation of youngsters coming up who will never have known the stability of a family and a home. Now, saying you can turn something off is ridiculous when in most cases it is not a parent who is controlling what is watched on television at all. Those kids are controlling it. And in some cases, even where parents are present, the kids are still controlling it because the kids are in charge. You know, back in the 1940s, it used to be very embarrassing for anybody to admit that they got pregnant out of wedlock. When I was a youngster in high school in Eugene, Oregon, I think it was one case in the entire 3 years that I was in that high school of one girl, and it was hushed. It was talked about in whispers, and it was kind of an undercurrent of gossip all over that school of how horrible it was that this one girl became pregnant and had to be sent to Portland. In those days, see, the big city with a hospital where it could be kept quiet, and maybe, who knows, an illegal abortion could have been performed back during those days. Well, then the idea was she had to go to Portland. See, we lived in Eugene. That was about 70 miles away from the biggest city in Oregon, which is Portland. My, how times have changed. Now, Donald Trump and his girlfriend have an illegitimate baby. Now, you know, the word bastard is a word that is often used as a slang term in cursing, but it's a legitimate English word that merely means an illegitimate child. It is used in the Bible, the Word of God, in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, isn't it? Where God's Word says, if we are not corrected, then are you bastards and not sons. But nobody walks up to the Trump baby and says, cute little bastard, isn't it? You know, if people would do that, maybe it would make the parents a little more aware of what is going on. You might think I just said something that is a bad word. No, it's an English word. It is a bad word because it's very, very bad for people to have children out of wedlock. But if people would walk up and say, let me hold the little bastard, it would be a completely different reaction from these parents instead of people cooing and, oh, isn't that a sweet little girl, little baby there? Oh, isn't that a precious little child? And so they're proud of it. It's out of wedlock. It's an illegitimate child. It is a bastard. In John Jake's series of books, there was a man of illegitimate birth among, in his at least fanciful and mostly novelized history of the development of the United States from the colonial period through the American Revolutionary War. And he had one book by the title out there that sold, I guess, several million copies called The Bastard. And it was about the illegitimate young man and how he became a success and so on. So again, I merely want to caution you, the word bastard is in the Bible. Look it up in your dictionary. I know that it's used in slang as a bad word that someone hurls at somebody else to put him down. But it is a word that means exactly what it means out of the dictionary, and I think it should be used of illegitimate children because there are millions of them around today. Now, why is it that when people are convicted or taken in and arrested for these crimes, they get away with it? Doesn't that make you just shake your head and wring your hands and be one of these who sigh and cry for the abominations around you? I can't believe it. I will read article after article after article. I will see telecast after telecast of people who have been convicted of 25 crimes, 52 crimes, who are arrested, and usually, as in the case of those who murdered Michael Jackson's father, the case of those who have been arrested for murdering German and other civilians, British, tourists down in Florida, the case of those who sometimes have murdered policemen, you will find out those individuals have been arrested for violent crimes, for assault with a deadly weapon, possession of a gun, for robbery, armed robbery, and so on, over and over and over again. But now we have what is called plea bargaining. So they come along and the prosecutors say, I'll tell you what, we're terribly overburdened. We probably can't get a conviction because even if we have a smoking gun, the court's going to throw it out and say you can't have that. Even if we've got a videotape of somebody trying to smash somebody's head in, we can't prove it was assault with a deadly weapon because you don't know what was going on in his mind. And you're aware, as I am, of the brick incident and of the Reggie Denny's now, and the brick, and the song, and the whole bit, right? Because of sensational trials where juries have acted as a result of mass fear and intimidation. Fear that their whole city is going to go up in flames if they dare to convict somebody of a crime they saw him commit. So we got plea bargaining. It was murder, but let's call it involuntary manslaughter. It was rape, but let's call it sexual harassment. It was arson, but let's call it misdemeanor. You know what misdemeanor is? Demeanor is behavior. Misdemeanor is misbehavior. Let's call it misbehavior. Let's say, even though he burnt down the forest and burnt down 120 homes, he was naughty. That's what the judges do. Why, you naughty boy. You've been naughty. That's a misdemeanor. You see some of these people involved in beating a man nearly to death? They were let off on a misdemeanor charge. And the time they sat there awaiting the trial has been applied to the days they would have spent in jail, so they're free to go. It was a vicious beating with a brick, but let's call it assault. And not even assault with a deadly weapon, because they didn't succeed in killing him. So it's simple assault. Then let's reduce the sentence. And after that, let's parole him. And then he's back out on the street. And in the case of the Rodney King incident, two times since then, he's been arrested again for drunken driving and public disturbances and mayhem of some sort or another. The guy has been arraigned again a couple of times. That didn't cure him. Even his tearful appeal to the citizens of Los Angeles, please don't burn the city down anymore, didn't change his heart and his character. He's still the same kind of a character. So now we've got all of these weeping, hair-shirted, hand-wringing, teary-eyed, tremble-chinned, liberal breast-beaters standing around demonstrating against capital punishment. Oh, to kill somebody who killed somebody else would be cruel, unusual, and inhuman punishment. And beside that, it's not a deterrent. What, you mean if you fry him with 1,000,000 volts, he's going to jump out of the electric chair and go kill somebody else? What do you mean it isn't a deterrent? He's not going to kill anybody else, is he? And you know, if you did it in public, if you let the public watch while they shave his head, if you let the public watch while they lead him with his toes dragging, weeping between two big old burly policemen, strap him in that chair, or if you spring the trap door and let the public watch while he hangs, I think it would be a major deterrent. But if you and I think that we're going to see the kind of criminal justice put in place in the United States of America that would treat and reduce crime, we're both crazy. The legislators who love their cushy jobs, big offices, large salaries, perks, free travel and free automobiles, and a whole bevy of secretaries and a host of all kinds of aides, and I mean by this assistants, by the way, are not going to pass the kind of laws that would be unpopular with a particular constituency. And the same thing is true of the entire House of Representatives and all of the Senate. I think all of the senators ought to turn in their diaries, don't you? If all the senators turned in their diaries, they would all be under indictment. We would find out that not only they have been kiting checks, which we know a lot of them have been doing, which you and I cannot do or we would go to jail. We would find out they've been taking free trips on the government, maybe taking stamps, paper clips, and envelopes out of their office, not paying for them. And we'd find out that probably a tremendous number of them have got little girls stashed away someplace on the side. It would make interesting reading. I think they all ought to turn in their diaries. I can't imagine why they would even keep a diary, frankly, except that every one of them wants to be president. And they think that eventually, if they get to be president, their diary will be worth some money because they can get great big bucks from either Hollywood or some publisher to publish their great big life story. That's what it's all about. So, these legislators ensconced in various jobs and offices who are responsible for passing the laws that have hamstrung the entire police forces of the United States of America, who just practically weep with frustration when they're out there laying their lives on the line every single day and every single night. They're making drug busts. They're arresting people in the process of committing brutal crimes. They haul them in before a judge. He slaps them on the wrist, puts them back out on the street, and in less than a week, they may be dealing with that same individual in another violent crime, and they just got through arresting him last Tuesday. And you talk to the average law enforcement agent, to a policeman on the beat. We see them being murdered in the line of duty almost daily in the United States, and you will find that what I just told you is absolutely true. It is about time we understood the why of it all. In Deuteronomy 28, I'm going to read to you a series of cause and effect, of blessings and cursings, a series of hazards and benefits. In Deuteronomy 28, it says, "It shall come to pass, if you will hearken diligently unto the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe and do all his commandments, which I command you this day, that the Eternal your God will set you on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on you and overtake you, if you shall hearken unto the voice of the Eternal your God." Deuteronomy 28, 1 and 2. Why? Because God, by divine fiat, sitting in his heavenly armchair, would say, "I'm going to bless them"? Well, maybe, but that's not the whole story. The whole story is because Almighty God has put laws in effect and in force that are hidden and unseen. Laws that have to do with the weather. Laws that have to do with living in harmony with the environment rather than polluting and besmirching and befouling it. Laws that have to do with husband and wife and father and son and mother and daughter relationships. Laws that have to do with neighbor to neighbor, family to family, clan to clan, city to city. Laws that have to do with health, with physical debility and disease. And God laid out all of those laws, telling people what is good to eat and what isn't good to eat. What's going to hurt you in the long term and what's going to kill you in the short term. And God laid out laws having to do with the land, that you ought to put back exactly what you take out. And that you ought to let the land lie fallow every 7 years. And let that little thin veneer of topsoil, where the microbacterial action of breaking down other vegetable material into humus and producing new organic fertilizer takes place, if man will leave it undisturbed. And because these laws are there, and they are living laws, and they're in action, if we get in harmony with them, we experience an automatic blessing, as well as the added blessing from God. Here's the way he lists them. All these blessings shall come on you and overtake you, if you shall hearken to the voice of the Eternal your God. Blessed shall you be in the city. Are we? What about Detroit, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., where the mayor wanted them to call out the National Guard, where gunshots can be heard in the windows of the White House? What about Washington, D.C.? Here is our president, who is a weak, waffling, vacillating leader on foreign policy, that says, yes, we're going to intervene in Bosnia. No, not yet. Yes, we'll prevent the people from flying in certain corridors. No, we won't. Yes, we will lift the arms embargo. No, we won't. Yes, we'll send troops down. I couldn't believe what I heard when he said, we're going to send troops down there. We're going to increase the number of people in Somalia because we're not going to withdraw our military forces. Listen to this. I'm quoting President Bill Clinton, quote, until we can do so safely, end quote. Oh, for pity's sake. You mean to tell me that thousands upon thousands of military men with their machine guns and mortars and rocket-propelled grenades and their automatic and semi-automatic shoulder-fired weapons, with their battle shoes and clothing and their flak jackets and their night vision devices and their helmets and all of their armored vehicles, cannot withdraw from a civilian population safely? What does it take for an armed man to withdraw from civilians safely? Oh, then we've got men down there who are under arms, right? And we've got to send more men under arms to help those men under arms to withdraw safely. Do you understand that? I don't understand that. But that is a direct quotation from the commander-in-chief. Now, we got a problem. I don't know if I can substantiate what I heard in some of the rather conservative media that Mr. Bill Clinton was allegedly overheard to say, I can't give them, meaning the Black Caucus in the United States, this and that and the other thing that they want, but I can give them Haiti. Now, I'd love to have that documented, but here again we have injected hundreds of millions of dollars, probably eventually going to be billions of dollars, who knows what kind of morass we're going to sink down into. and little babies are starving and dying as a result in Haiti. We're doing to the people we're trying to help what we didn't want to do to them. And we placed these Navy ships out there to actually strangle the flow of oil and everything except food and medicine into Haiti. So, in a sense, here's the way it works. President Bill Clinton, as the commander-in-chief, is told by Boutros Ghali, "We got a problem over here in Rwanda. Good, we'll send the army. We got a problem over here in Mogadishu. Good, we'll send the army. We got a problem down here in Haiti. Good, we'll send the Navy. We got a problem up here in Macedonia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Good, we'll send the Air Force." Here comes the mayor of Washington, D.C. "We got a problem right here in Washington, D.C. We need the National Guard, just the National Guard, to call them out and keep control of these streets where all these gangs are killing one another and drive-by shootings, bullets flying around the neighborhood. Forget it," says the commander-in-chief. "We're not going to let you do that." "I understand it," I say with tongue-in-cheek. "Isn't that incredible? We can inject tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young American men and women into trouble spots overseas, but our commander-in-chief refuses to let some of those battle-clad people patrol some of the streets of his own capital city." My, what have we come to? "All these blessings shall come on thee. Blessed shall you be in the city." Are we blessed in the cities? "And blessed shall you be in the field." Are we blessed in the field? Have you heard about the soybean crop? You heard about the corn crop? Down by about a third this year. You know why? Those huge floods. And don't also worry about, stem rust and root rot and nematodes and crop blight as a result of monoculture, where you have huge miles of one crop, where if you do get a disease, it just runs rampant instead of planting it the way you really ought to. About six rows of this and some grass in between and six rows of something else, or you don't lose the entire crop. "Blessed shall you be in the field." Well, we're not. And it says, "Blessed shall be the fruit of your body." If I were to sit here and give you statistics about mental aberrations, about children who are being born as a result of women who are on alcohol and drugs, of everything from the thalidomide of the 1960s to some of the antibiotics and the drugs and the alcohol and the cigarette smoke that people are imbibing and ingesting today, about twisted, deformed little children, about children with Down syndrome, about everything from Siamese twins to children that are blind at birth, that got weeping, running sores at birth, the children are coming off in screaming heebie-jeebies in a withdrawal from cocaine at birth, it would make you so sick you would want to vomit. "Blessed shall be the fruit of your body." And anymore, it's a kind of a Russian roulette when you watch the baby to be born to find out with all the five fingers. All parents, of course, have always, counted the fingers and toes. And always, the baby whole? Is the baby well? Is the baby all there? And I'll tell you, far more than ever before today, the baby isn't all there. "Blessed shall be the fruit of your body." If we would obey the laws that would cause that to happen, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your kind, and the flocks of your sheep. "Blessed shall be your basket and your store." That's your national reserves. That's your emergency oil and food stocks. It says, "Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out." And how is it today? When the man comes in, he's utterly exhausted. Why? Because he probably wants to live somewhere and drive all kinds of miles in a freeway to a frantic job where he is taken in a little bitty kind of a cart with a greasy cable up a black cavernous elevator tube to a, 56th floor building office where he sits around enervated, exhausted, jangled with all kinds of office politics and problems. And then, of course, he's already been subjected to the morning news before he left home. And he heard about the latest murders and arrests and the latest wars and the latest concerns over everything from health care to his rising taxes to his shrinking wages and the government telling him that even if he's got a good job, he ought to be in fear every day that he's going to lose it because of this and that, and people arguing about whether NAFTA is going to erode his job or not. And so when he comes home, he's in a kind of a mindless funk. He's sitting there kind of like a vegetable with little circles for eyes, with a dim screech in his ear of all the cacophony of traffic sounds and noise and screeching tires and wailing sirens. Now he turns on the evening news and Peter Jennings gives him all the latest news about murders and fires and riots and race problems and kidnappings and what Boutros Ghali is doing. And he sits there just going tilt in his chair. And then he wonders why he can't sleep at night. But never fear, because in between the evening news, he sees all these ads, people leaping around telling him about the latest tranquilizer of some kind, or the latest new additive to anything from Tylenol to Alka-Seltzer. So he can ingest a few of those and lie there all night in a night sweat with nightmares, with his body twitching, staring at his brains, wakes up, staggers into the bathroom to look at his eyes. They're all red. He doesn't feel like he's even gotten a good night's sleep. He's already jaded and exhausted, and he goes through the same process over again. That's life, the way it is lived by the man in the gray flannel suit in their millions upon millions from Wall Street to Beverly Hills every single day. It says, blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. That's whether you're going on a trip or whether you're going to work. The Eternal shall cause your enemies that rise up against thee to be smitten before your face. They shall come out against thee one way, and shall flee before thee seven ways. The Eternal shall command the blessing upon thee in your storehouses, and in all that you set your hand unto. Why? Why would he do that? He says, if you will only obey his laws. What laws? The laws of God, the Ten Commandments, the laws that have to do with marriage, with rearing our children. You know, they talk about man and woman and father and mother as role models. Isn't it amazing how the movies have so affected even our language that people think that a father in charge of a home is playing a role, acting a bit part? They're not a role model. They're an example. Now, when you've got situations like we have in our society today, where these breastfeeding, liberal, hair shirt, weeping, sob sisters have managed to somehow so water down our laws that it is against the law of the nation for your child to pray in public school, but it's not against the law for all that violence and mayhem and homosexuality and sodomy and everything else to be portrayed on the screen in front of your startled eyes every single night. This nation is in defiance of Almighty God in heaven above, and we are suffering the cursings as a direct result. And God goes on to list those cursings that I'm going to give you in just a moment to conclude this tape. But, you know, the time was back a few years ago when the hippies and some of these people that began to become, as they called, hepcats. You know where that came from? Back in the days, the early days of jazz, when rock and roll was yet uninvented, someone who was kind of dancing around and tapping his feet, maybe played the spoons or something, and was getting into a lot of this rhythmic music that really came right out of the heart of Africa, was called a hepcat. Later on, the word hep meant he was in, he was on top of it, he understood, he was hep, man. Like, finally, hep became hip. I'm hip. Well, hip merely meant a kind of a corruption of hep, and hep is a kind of a slang word that isn't really in the English language anyway. So instead of being a hep cat, he became a hippie. And hippie became a term that merely meant somebody that had so-called dropped out, tuned in, had become anti-establishment, and was probably listening to Dr. Timothy O'Leary and dropping sugar cubes with LSD on it and blowing his mind. Now, the hippie would see a man who would dress maybe the way I am today in a shirt and a tie, and he would take his fingers and he would just make this big square and have this disdainful look of hauteur and pained expression on his face and walk away. What a square. There were movie scenes where they didn't even say the word. They just looked at each other in pity, and one of them made a square sign to the other. You know, when I grew up, if you were squarely out of debt, if you were a square shooter, if you would give someone a square deal, if you ate three square meals a day, and especially in the Navy, where everything you did to make things shipshape, whether it had to do with sweeping down the ladders and cleaning up your barracks or cleaning up your part of the ship, was called getting squared away. And that merely meant neat. Isn't it amazing how in our rotten, filthy, degraded society, as we have ridden the toboggan slide into the slop chute of vomit and filth, that every word, even that meant something decent and good, has been completely turned around and perverted and twisted, and they make fun of it today. A traditional family is bad. They'll make fun of you. They make fun of a father and a mother with two children that they teach to be obedient. Your children are more precious and more of more value to you than a dog or a parrot. I can teach a dog to be obedient. I can teach a dog to be housebroken. You can teach a dog not to make a mess on your rug. You can teach a dog, believe it or not, to come when he's called. Here, Rover. Here he comes. You can teach a dog, go fetch. The dog will go fetch. Go get your slipper. Go get the paper. I remember my uncle's dog would go fetch the cows. He would say, go get the cows, Rover. And the dog would disappear in the bottom 40. And after a while, we'd hear the cowbell. And here came Clarabelle and Whifflehoofer and Jennifer and all the other cows that Uncle Dwight had. And the dog behind him just barking happily because the dog was trained to go get the cows. You know how you do that with children? You use the word no. And you follow it by mild punishment. Maybe two fingers high on the thigh or on a little bottom, a couple of sharp little slaps, just enough to sting, but not enough to ever bruise or injure in any way. And you teach them. You teach them that there's a time when they sit and fold their hands and they are quiet. You teach them that there's a time in a restaurant when they sit and look around with a happy smile on their face and they don't throw the silverware on the floor because they love to hear mommy say, uh-oh, and they think it's funny. And so they just keep doing it. And so mommy picks it up and he does it again. And then mommy picks it up and he does it again. You've seen it. I've seen it. It's absolutely ridiculous. And it's why, back in the 1950s, that I used as my thesis for my master's degree in Ambassador College, child psychology and child rearing. And hopefully I will at some time, and I know I'm trying to bite off more than I can chew, but I've got on the back burner a book that I want to reproduce and updated. Rearing of children or parenting. I don't know what the title will be as yet, but it'll be a child-rearing book on the subject of how to rear children because it is so desperately needed. But we're looking now at a society for which a current generation, you may as well say it's far too late. The unborn, the little children that we can reach through God's church and through God's radio, television programs and our literature and so on, maybe we can help. But stop to think about this. I have been talking about child rearing. I have been talking about husbands and wives and families, and I've been ranting and raving against divorce and abandonment and desertion and against all of these things that tear marriages and homes apart and let children become little wild animals out here that by the time they're 15 or 16 have picked up a gun and killed somebody. I have been talking about it for nearly 40 years, oftentimes at the top of my lungs. If I thought that my radio and television programs were supposed to make a difference, if they were supposed to really change an overall trend in our society, I think I would have given up and quit long ago. I can almost be a Jeremiah and remember the Lamentations where he said his tears ran down his face all the day long for the horrors that he saw coming upon his people, and all of his warnings were to no avail. Those terrible curses came upon those people anyway. Now to conclude this, let's notice what God says. He says, if you will not hearken, verse 15 of Deuteronomy 28, unto the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe and do all his commandments. Again, I ask, what's wrong with them? The answer is nothing. Wouldn't you love to have your neighbor be a person who would never cheat or steal, be a person who would never cast lustful eyes on your property, your car, your crops, your dog, your wife, your children? Wouldn't you love him not to be a pedophile, not to be a vicious killer, not to be someone who hates you, which is so true in so many societies today? Yeah, we'd love to have our neighbors keep the Ten Commandments, every single one of them, except some people balk about that fourth one. And if you're one of those, you need to get our booklet about Saturday, Sunday, which... There's nothing wrong with the Ten Commandments. They are the very basis of any civilized society. And any child who was ever taught to obey the laws of God will have no trouble at all obeying the laws of the land. He'll be a decent, respectful young child who appreciates the sanctity of human life, who appreciates the rights and the properties of other people, and who will never allow himself to become so brutalized and so desensitized, so calloused and so traumatized by watching 11 or 20 or 30,000 murders that he might react the way those two young boys did in England. Yes, even the British are not impervious to this. So it took a little 5-year-old boy out and beat that little child to death just because they wanted to know how it felt. They didn't want to know how it felt to be beaten. They didn't want to know how it felt to be kicked. They wanted to know how it felt to beat. Because, you see, their parents, no doubt, if you were to go back and find out what kind of child rearing they'd had, what kind of training, what kind of discipline, from what kind of a home did they come, we don't have that information, do we? We don't know if they came from a two-parent family or a single-parent family. We know nothing at all about which church they went to. What was their political persuasion? I'm talking about the family, about the parents. We know nothing at all except over in England, this horrifying crime that has actually shamed and rocked the entire nation of two young boys, I think about 10 and 11, just youngsters, preteens, beat to death a beautiful little 5-year-old child. That's enough to make you want to vomit. God says, I say, if you will not obey my commandments and the statutes that I command you this day, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city. And we are cursed in Washington, D.C., and in Dallas-Fort Worth, and in Houston, and in Atlanta, and San Antonio. And we're cursed in Pasadena, California, and in Detroit, and in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and San Francisco, where San Francisco stands for homosexuality, where they think it was Adam and Steve, not Adam and Eve, and where even our NEA, National Education Association, is injecting the kinds of booklets and things into our educational systems in New York City, where they're educating children at the kindergarten and the first year level about daddy's roommate. And they're holding up sodomy and homosexuality as being merely an alternative lifestyle. I can tell you on this tape that anyone who commits a homosexual act is a rotten, depraved, filthy pervert, a rotten queer. I can tell you that on this tape. I can't say that over at Superstation WGN. They won't let me say that. They won't let me say on that station. That's how far we've come to where the management of even public information media will actually prevent you from preaching the truth of God and crying aloud and sparing not and showing God's people their rotten, filthy sins. They won't let you do it. Just like our Supreme Court won't let your child pray in school. You think our nation is not due for a whipping? You think we're not due for retribution? You think we're not due for the Great Tribulation? You think Almighty God is going to tolerate this nonsense much longer? He said, cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your store. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body, and the fruit of your land, the increase of your kind, and the flocks of your sheep. Cursed shall you be when you come in and you go out. And that's describing life in the United States of America today. And it also says that later on, and this is going to come, it says the Eternal will cause you, verse 25, to be smitten before your enemies. You will go out one way against them and flee 7 ways and shall be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. And he says he's going to smite you with the botch of Egypt and hemorrhoids and the scab and the itch whereof you cannot be healed. He will smite you with madness, that is insanity, with mental problems, with blindness, and with heart disease. That's in verses 27 and 28. Verse 33, the fruit of your land and all your labor shall a nation which you know not eat up. Verse 43, look at how applicable this is to our so-called multicultural society. We're now supposed to be a multicultural society, and the current issue of Time magazine has a computerized picture of the American woman of the future that is a blend of about 14 or 20 different races as miscegenation and intermingling and cohabiting and intercopulating between all these different races is taking place in the United States. It says in verse 43, the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and you shall come down very low. He shall lend to thee. If the Japanese didn't show up to buy up our paper to actually possess the notes against the debt of the United States of America, we would have been bankrupt, as we really are anyway. It's all just a lot of paper inflation, but we would have been bankrupt long ago. And you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. God eventually says, In verse 49, the Eternal will bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth. And it will be as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose tongue you do not understand. Write for my brochure, New Order Coming in Germany, and find out what that scripture might mean. I tell you, the United States is a God-defying, God-rejecting, God-ignoring, commandment-breaking, sin-sick society. And God is going to punish our people like He has never punished any people in the history of the world if we do not individually and collectively repent. And so, I conclude this one message, which I wish could be heard by every American, from the White House to the lowliest street person who doesn't have a place to lay his head down at night, and by every person inside every prison in the United States. But unfortunately, it's only going to be heard by those of you who wrote in response to my letter that I sent you about this message, Cry Aloud and Spare Not. Will you help me do that? Will you help me do it on a personal basis? Will you help me do it in your own family, in your own community? Will you help me do it in your own local church? Will you help me do it on the telecast? Will you help me do it by writing the kind of articles and booklets that people ought to read to get them to repent? I will leave the answer to you. Goodbye, friend.